The group burst out of the riverbed and onto a flat plain, stretching ahead of them as far as Anya could see in the moonlight. The horsemen spread out into a wide arc on either side of Anya's rescuer, and she could see that there were at least a dozen, maybe more. They were dressed just as the Bedouin pretenders had been, in black desert garments that covered them from head to toe. Only the strip around their eyes had been left free, the rest of their faces covered by their keffiyehs.
Où me prenez-vous?
Anya asked where she was being taken, but the man only glanced at her. A burst of gunfire whizzed over their heads, and the lights of a moving vehicle splashed across the group. Anya glanced over her rescuer's shoulder. One of Grimes' land cruisers churned along in their wake. They must have come down the ridgeline by the path they'd originally taken to get to the dig, and then cut across country to flank Anya. Without a word, the riders split into two packs. Half of them closed ranks and cut to the left, charging diagonally away from the pursuing vehicle, while the other half, including Anya, did the same in the opposite direction. The other riders with them closed up ranks around Anya, doing what they could to shield her from being noticed. The driver of the SUV continued in a straight line, apparently undecided about which group to pursue.
The other way, go the other way.
The Land Cruiser jerked right and headed after Anya's group.
Can't a girl catch a break?
To her surprise, her rescuer was amused by her remark. The rider leaned forward to provide less of a target, forcing Anya to do the same. Then she realized that her rescuers were firing back. Anya watched as the rider to their left was toppled from his saddle. The man's horse charged forward. Grimes's men were trying to spook the horses, but these mounts must have been exceptionally well trained. They responded to the rider's commands with just the slightest touch. Darkness fell once more as the headlights and floodlamps of the SUV were extinguished with several carefully placed shots. Instantly, the pack divided once more, the riders breaking off onto individual paths, splitting up and again offering multiple targets. Anya was amazed at their coordination.
Whoever these men are, they've ridden together for some time.
A stray bullet caught their horse in the side of the chest. Anya's head hit a nearby rock. Anya awoke to find herself lying on a cot inside a large safari tent. She blinked several times, trying to figure out what she was seeing. Then she sat up abruptly, remembering the gunfight. The pain pulsed inside her head like a living thing. She closed her eyes and held her head in her hands as she waited for the pain to pass. It took a long time, and her stomach was queasy afterward, which told her she'd best take it easy for a few days until she could be sure she didn't have a concussion.
A concussion is the least of my worries if I've been captured by Grimes and Connolly.
The fact that she was lying on a clean bunk inside a tent gave her hope. The light in the tent let her know the night had passed. From the look of it, it was at least mid-afternoon, if not later. She was dressed in the clothing she'd been wearing the night before, but the cuts on her hands and face had been cleaned and treated. A stiffness around her right biceps let her know that the bullet wound there had been cleaned and swathed in bandages as well. She got up off the cot slowly, discovering as she put her feet on the floor that she was still wearing her boots. That was something else to be thankful for. The way she was feeling, she never would have been able to pull them on by herself. She walked gingerly until she reached the entrance to the tent. Steeling herself, she stuck her head out the door. Anya was in the midst of a simple desert camp. A smaller tent stood next to the one she was in, and between them was a smoldering fire. An iron rack had been set up over the fire, and several pots were resting on it, the smell of a meal emanating from them. A table stood nearby, and a long-legged, silver-haired man was seated there, food laid out before him. He must have heard her because he turned and smiled when he saw her standing in the doorway of the tent.
Hello, Anya.
Anya stared at Rue for a long moment and then crossed the distance between them. Rue didn't move, though the slap made the smile on his face falter just a little.
I guess I deserved that.
You guess?
Now, Anya, let's discuss this calmly, please.
You want to discuss this calmly? After you sent armed gunmen to kidnap me and attack my camp? Are you out of your mind?
I had good reasons, Anya. And if you'd stop shouting for 5 minutes, perhaps I'd have the opportunity to explain. Now, sit down before you fall down.
Anya slowly lowered herself into one of the chairs at the table and glared at Rue.
That's better. Would you like something to eat?
Rue gestured at the table, where there was a platter of stuffed Cornish hens, as well as bowls of fruits and vegetables. Anya suddenly realized she hadn't eaten since dinner the night before. The food smelled so good that she decided it would be foolish to let it go to waste, so she served herself.
I left for Monte Carlo shortly after we parted on Tuesday, and didn't realize that you'd signed on to help Connolly in his quest to solve the riddle of the scroll. As soon as I learned you had, I immediately returned to Jerusalem.
You could have just called me, you know.
Actually, I couldn't. I believe your phone is being monitored.
Run that by me again?
Your phone isn't safe. I believe Connolly's chief of staff has been monitoring it since you left the city. He's an extremely dangerous man, Anya, as is his boss. They're after something more than this ridiculous treasure.
I know. He's after Aaron's staff. The staff of Judea.
You know about the staff?
Well, up until a few hours ago, I would have said no. But I'm a quick learner.
Anya told Rue about the events that had led her to eavesdrop on Connolly and Grimes, and what she had subsequently learned from Ephraim about the staff.
God damn it! Those greedy idiots. Hell and damnation.
I take it you believe the staff is real?
Of course it's real. Artifacts with true power such as this one are few and far between.
So let me see if I have this straight. You needed to reach me, but you were concerned that my phone was tapped. So instead, you came up with the bright idea of sending Parisian mercenaries dressed up as Bedouin raiders to the camp to scare us off. And when that didn't work, you ordered the same group to kidnap me right out from under everyone else's noses.
How did you know they were Parisian mercenaries?
Parisian accent, for one. Military surplus boots, for another. Lack of a decent tan, but familiarity with Bedouin customs suggested former service with the French Foreign Legion, for a third. That's just off the top of my head.
I see.
Rue?
Hmm?
Where are all your people?
People? There's no one here but me and Henshaw.
That's not what I meant. Where are the rest of your fake Bedouins? Do they have another camp of their own?
My Bedouins, as you call them, are dead, Anya. You said so yourself. Connolly's men killed them.
No, your other men. The ones who rescued me last night.
I am not sure what to tell you, Anya. It was by chance that Henshaw stumbled upon you last night while en route to my location. You were wandering in the desert with a wound to your head and a leather case clutched in one hand like a life preserver.
Wandering in the desert? That doesn't make any sense.
I didn't imagine those horsemen, and I certainly wouldn't have escaped from Grimes' security force without their help. Who on earth were they? And what happened after that horse was shot out from under me?
The case. Where is it?
Henshaw!
A moment later, the tall, British-trained butler Anya had first met at Rue's Paris estate stuck his head out of the other tent.
Sir,
bring me the device Anya had with her last night.
Of course, sir.
Henshaw disappeared back into his tent, only to emerge moments later with the iPad she'd fought so hard to protect. As he drew closer, Anya could see the cracks in the faceplate. But it wasn't until he actually handed it to her that she saw the full extent of the damage. There was a bullet hole right through the center of the device.
Damn. Oh. I suppose there's no chance of recovering the data stored on the drive, Henshaw?
There might be, but I don't have the necessary equipment here to do it.
Something important, I take it?
Oh, nothing much, really. Just the clues leading to the staff's hiding place.
Ah.
Rue got up from the table, disappeared inside his tent, and emerged a few minutes later with a few pieces of paper.
Will these help?
Ephraim's notes! Where did you get these?
You had them in your pocket when Henshaw found you in the desert. I couldn't make heads or tails of them.
Anya hadn't had time to examine them when Ephraim had given them to her, so she had no idea what Rue was talking about until she unfolded the pages. They weren't written in any language she was familiar with.
What the heck is this?
That's what I was hoping you could tell me.
Anya puzzled over it for a few minutes.
Perhaps you could fill me in on what's so amusing.
Do you have a mirror?
Rue glanced at Henshaw, who disappeared back into his tent and returned a few moments later with a handheld shaving mirror. Rue took it from him.
Hold it upright where we can see it.
Once Rue had, Anya held up one of the pages next to it, so that the writing on the page was reflected in the surface of the mirror.
Ah, it's still gibberish.
Anya took a peek, saw that it was, and quickly flipped the page over so that she was holding it upside down. The writing in the mirror transformed into perfectly readable English. In order to keep a casual observer from understanding what he had written, Ephraim had written his message upside down and backward. It was a clever trick, and one that didn't take too much time or effort to learn to do well. Somewhere in his past, Ephraim had clearly made use of the code before.
Ah. Let us see what Ephraim had to tell us, shall we?
Rue began taking notes as Anya read the pages off to him. Connolly and Grimes were sitting outside their tent, drinking scotch and quietly discussing the events of the night before. The encounter in the desert last night had been more a massacre than a firefight. They had taken 20 shots for every one the men on horseback had managed. It was only by sheer luck that any of the horsemen had escaped. If Beck's truck hadn't blown a tire at an inopportune moment, they probably would have slaughtered them to a man. As it was, only a few of them had gotten away. Unfortunately, one of those who'd escaped had been carrying Anya.
So now what?
I don't see any reason for us not to continue.
You don't think she'll go right to the authorities?
No. If that had been her plan, she never would have stayed behind for the iPad. No, she's after bigger game.
The treasure?
No. I think she's after the staff.
The staff? What on earth gives you that idea?
Think about it. If she just wanted the cash, all she had to do was stay with the expedition and take her share of the finder's fee when the time came. All above board and legal. The kind of money we're talking about here, she would have been richer than she ever imagined. To you, it's peanuts. But to someone like her? No, she's after the staff.
First of all, how does she even know about it? And second, what would she do with it?
Who cares what she'd do with it? That's beside the point. This woman made her career chasing down artifacts just like this. Do you really think she'd pass up the chance to be the one to discover the staff Aaron used to call down the plagues of Egypt?
No, I don't imagine she would.
Exactly. Neither do I. Which is why we have to get there first. And I know just how to do it. Let's go see if our guest is ready to talk, shall we?
They crossed the camp to where a new, large canvas tent had been erected. Johnson and Daniels stood guard outside.
Any problems?
Quiet as a mouse.
Let's see if we can make him more talkative then, shall we?
The three men stepped inside the tent, leaving Johnson to stand guard outside. A portable hoist, which they had brought along to remove heavy objects from the earth, stood in the center of the tent. It was cranked up to its highest setting. Hanging from it was Professor Ephraim Yellen. His hands had been tied together with cords, which were looped over the hook at the center of the hoist. Ephraim's feet, also bound together, were left hanging about an inch off the floor. It wasn't much, just a small distance, really. If he stretched himself to the limit, he could touch the toes of his shoes to the floor and take a little of the weight off his arms for a moment or two. But he couldn't hold the position for long. His arms and legs would start trembling. That, in turn, would set his body to rotating slightly on the hook above his head, and he'd be right back to where he was, hanging with all his weight on his arms. If left in that position, he'd eventually suffocate, as the muscles in his chest failed from the strain. Grimes expected him to break long before that point. Beck had needed to let off a little steam, so Grimes had allowed him to work the old man over, and it showed. The professor's face had taken a beating. One eye was swollen completely shut, the nose looked broken, and at least two teeth were missing. Grimes stepped around in front of Ephraim. The old man's head was hanging down against his chest, but Grimes noted with satisfaction that the prisoner was still conscious. Ephraim tracked Grimes' movement with his one good eye.
This doesn't have to continue, you know, Professor. Simply agree to do what we ask, and we'll have you down from there in a jiff. What do you say? Yes?
Go to hell.
As you wish, Professor. As you wish.
With a wave of his hand, Grimes summoned Daniels over to him.
Soften him up more so we can have another chat. Leave his face alone for now, though. I need him to be able to speak.
Understood.
Two hours later, Grimes stepped back into the tent. He carried a tablet computer in one hand and a cell phone in the other. The professor flailed about, trying to stretch far enough to stand on his toes and get a break. Daniels, who had been sitting in a camp chair a few feet away, watching the man struggle, jumped to his feet.
Take him down.
The other man walked over to the hoist controls and hit the release button. Grimes picked up the camp chair Daniels had been sitting in and placed it next to the professor.
Sit.
Ephraim only lay there. Grimes gestured to Daniels. Daniels hauled the prisoner off the floor and slammed him into the chair. A firm hand on the man's shoulder kept him from sliding off.
I want you to watch something, Professor. When you're finished, I'm going to ask you a question. I would think hard before I answer that question if I were you. Do we understand each other?
Grimes didn't wait for a reply. He thrust the tablet in front of Ephraim and swiped a finger across the screen.
No, no, please! Please don't! No! Leave me alone! Oh, no, no!
It wasn't a long video, just a few minutes in length. But Grimes' men advancing on one of the female students they'd captured along with the professor was enough to bring tears flooding down the man's cheeks.
I want you to take us to the staff, Professor Yellen. I will see to it that the students who agreed to follow you on your escape attempt will come to no further harm. So here's my question, Professor. Will you take us to the staff of Judea?
The transcription work took a couple of hours, after which Anya needed some time to look it over. Ephraim had tried to give her as much information as possible in the short time he'd had available to him, and as a result had used abbreviations and drawn connecting arrows between seemingly unrelated notations that took some time to decipher. It was morning before Anya thought she finally had it all straight in her head. She took it to Rue and spread her notes out in front of them.
All right, what have we got?
Well, according to Ephraim's notes, the clues in the scroll passages put the staff inside the fortress Moloch, near the Machtesh Gadol.
Right. Again, please. This time in English, if you don't mind.
All right, in English. According to the legend, Moloch was one of three major fortresses built by Herod the Great sometime between 30 and 45 BCE as places of refuge in the event of a revolt by his people. Unlike the other two, Masada and Herodium, Moloch was built in secret, its location known only to the king's closest family and confidants. Legend states that Herod slaughtered everyone involved in the construction of the fortress in order to keep its location an absolute secret. He must have done a decent job, too, because the fortress has never been found. Most people think it's a myth.
And you? What do you think?
If you'd asked me a month ago, I would have said it's about as real as Oz. After what I've seen this week, I'd be looking for the yellow brick road. So yes, I do think it's real. More importantly, so does Ephraim, and he's given us a location where he thinks we'll find it.
This Machtesh Gadol, or whatever you call it?
Right.
Anya pulled out a map of Israel that Rue had brought for their discussion and opened it. She put it down on the table in front of them so that they had a good look at the lower half of the country. She indicated a section of the map about two-thirds of the way down the length of the country.
This is the northern Negev.
She then pointed at a small dot on the map labeled Yeruham.
And this is one of the first of Israel's development towns, new communities created to help settle the influx of refugees from other nations shortly after Israel became a state.
Anya slid her finger across the map to the left, where a long, slim area was shown as a darker shade.
Just to the west is Machtesh Gadol. A Machtesh is a peculiar kind of formation caused by massive erosion over a geographically short period of time. Think of it as an oversized box canyon, if that makes sense, formed by the collapse of soft material under the weight of harder material above. It's essentially a deep valley surrounded by steep walls of resistant rock. Gadol means large in Hebrew, and for many years, Machtesh Gadol was thought to be the largest Machtesh in all of Israel.
But it's not any longer?
No. When it was named, no one knew about Machtesh Ramon, which is just over 40 kilometers in length. In contrast, Machtesh Gadol is only 10 kilometers long and 5 kilometers wide.
Why would anyone build a fortress at the bottom of a canyon? Your enemies could surround you before you even knew they were coming.
Remember, if the legends are correct, Malach was supposed to be the king's ultimate hiding place. He had Masada and Herodium to act as fortresses. Malach was supposed to be his hidden bunker that he could retreat to in the worst-case event. You would want a place like that to have the lowest profile possible, and hiding it in a canyon that most people avoid is about as low profile as you can get.
And this is where we'll find the staff?
According to Ephraim, it is. And he's rarely been wrong when I've worked with him in the past. It was his reasoning that helped us find the first two caches of treasure listed on the Copper Scroll. From what I overheard, Connolly's goal was the staff all along. Our work at the first two treasure sites was simply a test to see if Ephraim and I were reading the information contained in the scrolls properly. My guess is they'll bypass the rest of the sites and head directly for Malach.
Do you have any idea if that iPad was backed up?
Connolly was paranoid about translations of the scrolls getting out into other people's hands, so the only copy in camp was in that. That doesn't mean he doesn't have one somewhere else, though.
Let us say he does have one. How long will it take him to work this out?
I don't know. I'm hoping the theft of the iPad sets him back some. If our plan worked and Ephraim managed to make it back to Jerusalem and go to ground, that would slow him up even more. The trouble is that I don't know how much information Connolly had before he started this endeavor. He might have been sitting on the location the entire time.
Then we need to beat him to it.
Anya borrowed a satellite phone from Rue and tried to call Ephraim, but the professor didn't answer either his cell phone or his office line. A check of her own voicemail told her that he hadn't tried to call either. That worried her, but there wasn't much she could do about it now. With time at a premium, Rue made the decision to leave the camp intact and travel immediately to Machtesh Gadol. Anya agreed, even though she wasn't looking forward to the hours in an SUV driving through the desert. Anya helped Rue and Henshaw pack what little gear they couldn't leave behind. She, of course, was traveling light, with only the iPad and its case. She thought about leaving them behind, but at the last second had stuffed the damaged unit back into its case and slipped the case into one of Rue's bags. When there was time, she intended to see what other information might be stored on the device, if she could access any of it. When Anya went to load the gear, there wasn't a vehicle in sight. Her confusion must have shown on her face.
You didn't think I drove here from Jerusalem, did you?
Of course not. I thought Henshaw drove you.
Henshaw received a scowl from Rue for this rare demonstration of amusement, but the butler pretended not to notice.
This way, Miss Creed.
Henshaw hefted a duffel over one shoulder and led the way out of camp along a narrow footpath into the scrubland. They made their way through a thick boulder field for several minutes, and then up and over a few hills before coming to a small valley. Below them sat an unmarked black helicopter.
You'll ride, Miss Creed.
Flying time from their current location to Machtesh Gadol was a little more than 3 hours. Anya spent the time going over Ephraim's notes in more detail, doing her best to understand the directions he'd given her. She was so engrossed in her study that she didn't notice they'd arrived until the helicopter began descending. She looked out the window and took in the canyon below them. It looked like a giant hand had reached down and scooped out a long furrow in the earth. Anya marveled at its beauty. The strata in the rock were clearly visible, the darker bands of harder rock at the top sinking down into the softer, lighter bands at the bottom.
Can you do a flyby of each canyon wall?
I can certainly try, Miss Creed.
The canyon was just over 5 kilometers wide. There shouldn't be an issue. Henshaw arced the bird over and took them down into the canyon. He got as close as possible to the western wall and then advanced down the length of the canyon, giving both Rue and Anya time to study the stone, looking for any discernible clue as to the location of the fortress. When they were done with the west side, they turned around and did the same in the opposite direction. Truth be told, Anya really didn't expect to find anything. If it was that easy to spot, someone would have done it long before now. She believed in being thorough, however, and not taking time to do a visual search just seemed wrong. The flyby didn't turn up any clues, however.
Please put us down on the canyon floor close to the south end.
As you wish.
Henshaw quickly had the bird on the ground. They waited for the dust to settle and the rotors to stop spinning before climbing out. The canyon around them was quiet. Anya felt uneasy all of a sudden. She had the sense she was being watched, being observed, as if the rocks were waiting to see what they would do next.
Let us gear up and find these staff. We don't know how much time we have before Connolly catches up.
Henshaw pulled several large equipment bags out of the back of the helicopter and lined them up on the ground. Rue and Anya dug through them, taking out the gear they thought they would need and repacking it into smaller day packs they could carry with them. Anya took water, climbing rope, a knife with a decent-sized blade, a change of clothes, a compass, a small camp cloth, and a headlamp. The usual assortment of gear for a trip into a place where she didn't know what to expect. When they were finished, Rue turned to Henshaw.
There's no telling what Connolly will do when he gets here. Take the build up on the ridgeline so you've got more room to run if you need to. Keep us informed by radio as long as you can, and defend yourself if need be.
Of course, sir. Will that be all?
Yes. Thank you.
Anya and Rue moved a short distance away. Henshaw got back into the helicopter.
Henshaw has to be the most unflappable butler ever.
Go park the helicopter somewhere else, and oh, by the way, if somebody starts firing at you for no reason, feel free to blow them out of the sky.
Of course, sir. Very good, sir.
The dust that was whipped up by the spinning rotors caused Anya to turn away for a moment. When she looked back, Henshaw had taken the chopper out of the canyon to await their return from a safer location. Anya turned and looked out at the expanse of canyon before them. The canyon itself was a few kilometers in length, its walls climbing hundreds of feet off the ground. The canyon floor, especially near the outer edge, was littered with boulders and the remains of thousands of years' worth of rockfalls. The sun beat down, hot and heavy, while a thin breeze barely stirred the air.
Somewhere in there is the entrance to a fortress that no human being has set foot inside in 2,000 years. A fortress that we're supposed to find using clues left behind and a couple of ancient scrolls, with nothing but a few pages of notes and some old-fashioned guesswork. Piece of cake!
Indeed. Shall we?
Why not?
Connolly was concerned about the Creed woman, which meant that Grimes had to be as well. What bothered the boss the most was the way in which Creed had been rescued by those horsemen last night, just as Grimes had effectively run her to ground. The speed at which they had appeared and the way they had intentionally blocked the security team's fire to protect her suggested she'd been working with the intruders all along. Creed had escaped and had taken the iPad containing a good portion of their information about the staff with her. Connolly wanted her tracked down and dealt with as swiftly as possible. The project Grimes had assigned to Douglas was intended to do just that.
Well?
Douglas made one last adjustment to the tracking device on the table, then closed the access panel and handed it to Grimes.
Finished, sir. Sorry
it
took so long.
Just as long as it works, Douglas.
Oh, it will, sir. I guarantee it.
Grimes handed the tracker to Connolly.
Thought I'd let you do the honors.
Connolly turned the device over a few times.
So how does this work again?
There's a GPS transmitter in your tablet, just like a cell phone. Douglas hacked into the cell network to get your individual GPS signal and then modified the tracking software in the handheld so that it would look for your tablet rather than the beacon it had originally been designed to hunt down. He also extended the reach of the device by allowing it to use our satellite network. When you flick the switch, the tracker should show us the current GPS position of your iPad. All we have to do from there is follow it.
And where we find the tablet, you expect to find Anya.
I do.
And what are we waiting for?
As Grimes looked on, Connolly flicked the switch. For a moment, nothing happened. The screen stayed blank. Connolly opened his mouth to say something, but Grimes held up a hand.
It's just calibrating. Give it a moment.
A red dot appeared at the bottom right of the screen. Next to that dot were coordinates. North, 30 degrees, 55 minutes, 30 seconds. East, 34 degrees, 58 minutes, 52 seconds.
Douglas?
The former commando punched the coordinates into his computer. A moment later, a name popped up on the screen. Mahtesh Gadol. Anya and Rue stuck close to the east wall of the canyon, following it for about a kilometer to where a series of caves became visible in the walls above them. Anya guessed there had to be at least 200 of them, if not more. According to Ephraim's notes, the entrance to the fortress was hidden in one of those caves. To find the right one, they were to look for the symbol of the guide in the night, a reference, Ephraim believed, to the ancient Jewish belief that God led Moses and the Israelites across the desert during their years of exile with a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night.
But what does a stone pillar of fire look like? Will we even know it when we see it? Only one way to find out.
They began the slow, painstaking search. They started with the larger cave mouths closest to the ground, checking each one for the expected symbol before using some of the chalk Anya had brought along to mark off those that had been investigated from the dozens of others around them. With so little information to go on, they were careful to explore as many possible candidates as they could, a decision that was going to add to the time it would take to complete the task, but would also keep them from overlooking the right cave because they didn't exactly know what they were looking for. They'd been at it for only a half hour when a hawk caught Rue's attention. He watched it circling high above them for a few minutes while Anya checked out the next hole in the canyon wall. At first, he'd taken it for some kind of drone. It circled so perfectly above their position. He'd drawn a handgun out of his pack and gotten ready to try to shoot it down when the bird folded back its wings and went into a steep dive. Rue followed it down as it plunged toward the earth, no doubt about to make some other desert creature's life a good degree shorter, and he watched as it disappeared behind a vertical pillar of rock that seemed to twist and move in the bright light of the afternoon sun.
The pillar of fire.
The hawk burst from cover, a mouse in its talons, and Rue saluted it as it flew away. He kept his gaze on the pillar from behind which the hawk had emerged.
I think I've found it.
Anya was just emerging from a cave several yards to his left and quickly joined him.
Take a look at that vertical rock formation over there. Wouldn't that suggest a pillar of fire to you?
I think you're right. Let's check it out.
The two of them made their way over. Up close, the optical illusion that made the stone pillar look like it was flickering like the flames of a fire disappeared, leaving them staring at nothing more than a tall hunk of freestanding stone. Behind it, half hidden in the shadow cast by the 10-foot column, was a narrow opening in the rock. As cave mouths went, it wasn't much, just a small opening near the floor of the canyon, so low that Anya had to get down on her knees and bend to look inside. The sunlight barely reached inside the hole, so Anya dug her headlamp out of her pack and put it on. With the help of its light, she could see that the cave opened up considerably once you got past the first several feet. A bend in the tunnel kept her from seeing too far inside, but it seemed clear that beyond the cave mouth was a rather substantial tunnel leading deeper under the cliff wall.
I'm going in there.
Before her companion could reply, she had stripped off her pack and, pushing it ahead of her, climbed inside the cave mouth flat on her stomach. There wasn't a lot of wiggle room. The sides of the tunnel were very close. She barely had enough space to wiggle her hips back and forth to get some momentum going as she pulled herself forward with her hands. For just a second, she thought about the several million tons of rock hanging suspended just above her head, waiting to come crashing down and bury her for all eternity. Then she banished the thought.
If it's going to come down, there's nothing I can do about it anyway.
After several minutes of effort, she slid out of the entrance tunnel and into a small chamber. By the light of her headlamp, she could see that it was roughly circular, with another tunnel mouth opening directly across from the one she'd just entered through. This other opening was much larger, however. Neither she nor Rue would have any difficulty walking upright. Her light fell on the space directly above the tunnel mouth, and she froze, her eyes widening at the sight. Carved into the lintel of the tunnel mouth was an intricately stylized pillar of flames and several words written in what could only be Hebrew. She couldn't read them, but that was okay. She already knew what they said.
Welcome, Anya. Or at least that's what they're saying to me.
Anything?
Oh, nothing much. Just the hidden entrance to King Herod's long-lost refuge. Yes, this is it!
Watch yourself, it's a tight squeeze.
Oh, hell. Damn it.
A few minutes later, Rue stood by her side. He glanced around, saw the writing above the tunnel mouth, and studied it for a moment.
With a pillar of fire, he led them to the promised land.
I didn't know you could read Hebrew.
You never asked.
Rue and Anya headed deeper into the mountain. They traveled forward for another 15 minutes without finding anything of interest. The tunnel meandered through several twists and turns, so much so that it became obvious the workmen had relied on an existing passage through the rock rather than carving their own straighter course. Aside from the carving at the entrance, the only clues that this was a man-made passage were the sconces set into the walls every 25 feet. At last, they emerged into an open chamber that was a good 50 feet across and at least 2 stories high. A wide beam of sunlight blazed down from the ceiling, the result of a perfectly placed shaft bored through to the surface that would capture the light at a specific time each day. Anya turned to follow the sunbeam. Just as with the ruins at Petra in Jordan, the entire rock wall at the far end of the chamber had been sculpted so it looked like the front of a temple building, complete with obviously false windows and balconies on the second floor, and 3 very real doorways directly ahead on the first floor. 2 large statues of a man Anya took to be King Herod stood on either side of the trio of doors, staring across the chamber at them with stern expressions. In a subtle hint of what lay inside, each statue held a shepherd's crook in their hands. Anya and Rue grinned at each other, their thoughts on the prize before them. They spotted the other chopper from the air and made a couple of passes over the site to be on the safe side. Even from a distance, Grimes recognized the make and model. The Bell 427 was a fairly common utility bird. The twin engines and 4-blade rotor system gave it both speed and versatility in the air, never mind a range of over 700 kilometers. This one was painted black and was completely bare of any kind of insignia or marking, including tail numbers. Looked abandoned.
Set us down a few dozen yards away from that other helicopter.
As soon as they were on the ground, Grimes, Beck, and Daniels were advancing on the other helicopter, weapons in hand. With the other 2 men covering him, Grimes threw open the door and discovered that his initial impression had been right. The cockpit was empty. Dust hadn't had time to build up on the windshield and the frame, however. Grimes had little doubt the chopper belonged to Anya and whoever she had managed to enlist to help her.
Daniels, Beck, search that chopper.
Right away, sir.
His opinion was confirmed when the search turned up Connolly's iPad, complete with its leather case. The bullet hole through the center of it was unfortunate. Grimes knew Mitchell was not going to be happy about that. The hair on the back of his neck stood on end as he suddenly felt like he was being watched. He spun around, his weapon up, and surveyed the boulder field surrounding their landing area, looking for a telltale hint of movement or the flash of sunlight on the glass of a spotting scope or pair of binoculars. Nothing. Still, the feeling persisted. Grimes turned to face his own chopper and held up 2 fingers, then pointed to the area around them. 2 more of his men climbed down from the chopper and headed in the direction he'd pointed, searching for whoever might be out there.
Better safe than sorry.
Grimes waited impatiently until the men, Gardner and Johnson, as it turned out, returned 15 minutes later.
Anything?
Looks like 2 people exited the aircraft and then wandered up here before descending into the canyon. I'm guessing a man and a woman, as one set of tracks is deeper than the other. Might even be a 3rd individual, but I'm less certain of that. Could just be a weak sign from 1 of the first 2.
All right. Keep your eyes open. Something doesn't feel right.
Grimes had long ago learned to trust his instincts, and right now those instincts were telling him that they weren't alone. Still, Gardner had said there might be one unconfirmed individual, not 50. How much damage could one guy do? If there was somebody out there, they'd neutralize him when the time came. Grimes returned to the chopper and brought Connolly up to speed. As expected, the boss wasn't happy about the tablet, but when Grimes let him know that they seemed to be close on the heels of Anya and whoever was assisting her, Connolly forgot about it in favor of focusing on the real issue, beating Creed to the staff.
What are we doing screwing around up here for, anyway? Creed's down there somewhere.
Connolly pointed at the lip of the canyon.
That's where we should be as well. Get in and let's get down there where we belong. We're not going to find the staff up here.
The canyon was wide enough that they could take off and land in the middle of it, saving them the effort of a descent, but Grimes was leery about doing so.
It's my guess that Anya arrived here ahead of us and is no doubt hunting for the entrance to the fortress even as we speak. We only made one pass over the canyon. When we came back to take a look at the chopper, we did so at an oblique angle, and that should have dampened the sound considerably. I doubt anyone knows we're here. Right now, we have a tactical advantage that we'd be foolish to waste, and landing in the center of the canyon would do just that.
Fine. Find us a way down there, and let's stop wasting time.
I'm sure our guest would be happy to help with that, right, Professor? And before you answer, let me remind you that the continued health and welfare of your students depends on how useful you are to us.
There's a trail to the canyon floor from the south escarpment. Once we're at the bottom, we need to look for the rock formation mentioned in the scroll.
Well done, Professor. Well done.
While the men gathered the gear they were going to need for what lay ahead, Grimes instructed the pilot to take the helicopter a safe distance away and to wait for Grimes' radio call for extraction. Just because his men hadn't found anyone watching them from the surrounding scrub didn't mean there wasn't someone out there. Grimes had no intention of leaving their transport home out here like a sitting duck. Yellen led them to a narrow defile that bisected the south end of the canyon, revealing a trail that led downward. Hamilton and Beck took point, their weapons at the ready. After them came Professor Yellen, Grimes, and then Connolly. Bringing up the rear were Daniels, Johnson, Douglas, and Gardner. The trail was narrow and steep, with plenty of loose stone underfoot to trip the unwary. Because of the condition of the trail, it took Grimes a while to notice it was man-made. Every now and then, he could see where ancient steps had been cut into the rock face in particularly difficult sections to help ease downward passage. The work was cleverly done. He wouldn't have noticed it if he hadn't known the fortress was nearby and been looking for some evidence of that. Once they reached the canyon floor, Grimes gave the group 5 minutes to rest and grab some water before they set out again. According to the professor, they were looking for a rock formation that looked like a pillar of fire. Once they found that, they would use it to locate the cave mouth that marked the entrance to the fortress. It sounded like a load of rubbish. 10 years ago, he would have laughed outright at the idea of hunting for a column of stone carved to look like a giant flame. But time and experience had changed his viewpoint. Locating the stone formation took them almost 3 hours. During their first search of the cliff face, they went right past it without noticing. It was only when the professor decided they'd gone too far and turned them around for a pass in the opposite direction that they saw it. The late afternoon sun set the rocks around them blazing, and even Grimes had to admit the column did look like an oversized flame. The cave didn't look like much. A child-sized hole at the base of the cliff wall. But the recent boot prints in the loose earth just outside it told them beyond a doubt they were on the right track. Grimes held the others back while Gardner had a look.
Just as I thought. Two people, most likely a male and a female, traveling together. Even better, it looks like the tracks are less than an hour old.
Hamilton, crawl in there and check it out.
Yes, sir.
Hamilton wiggled his way into the narrow passageway. It was a tight fit, given his broad shoulders, but he managed to push himself along with several hard thrusts of his legs. A few minutes after he'd climbed inside, he lit a magnesium flare, the light spilling back down the tunnel to the rest of them.
All clear, sir!
Johnson and Daniels, you're on watch. I want you to guard this entrance and make sure no one goes in or out without us. Douglas, Gardner, Beck, you've got rear guard. Follow us in.
Rue continued studying the three entrances outlined in the light ahead of them.
Right, left, or center?
Anya opened her mouth to reply, then paused.
I don't remember Ephraim's notes mentioning anything about choosing a door.
Just to be safe, Anya set her pack down and dug the pages containing Ephraim's scribbled notes out of the front pocket so she could double-check.
Nope. Nothing here. We're gonna have to guess.
Very well. I vote for the center.
The center? Why the center?
Why not?
Don't you think we need a more logical reason to make that choice than just because?
No. And have I ever told you that you overthink things?
Three doors. Which one to choose?
Like Rue with the middle entry, Anya would have taken the right one without much thought. It was a natural reaction for right-handed people. And that was the problem. Anya knew from experience that the guys who designed places like this were cut from the same cloth. Not only were they paranoid, knowing you could be beheaded at the king's whim for the slightest infraction, but they were also devious. She tried to put herself into the architect's shoes.
I don't know much about the history of Moloch, but as a last fortress and refuge for King Herod, it makes sense that the architect would make it difficult for an enemy to reach him. If it had been up to me, I would have booby-trapped two of the three entrances at the least. So if the natural inclination for most people is to take the right passage, wouldn't that be the one the architect would most likely use as a false entry? On the other hand, as a Jew, Herod would have seen the left hand as the unclean one and therefore might have objected to using that passage as the entrance into his private sanctum. Which brings us right back to Rue's suggestion, the center passage. I'm probably gonna regret this. Fine. Center it is.
They approached the opening cautiously and shone their lights over the threshold. A narrow corridor continued beyond as far as they could see. Unlike the previous corridor, this one was squared off, like a corridor in a freestanding building rather than the rounded natural tunnel they'd just left behind. A light breeze was blowing down the hall, just enough to stir the dust on the ground slightly, and Anya found herself marveling at the engineering involved to funnel fresh air this deep beneath the surface. It made her wonder what else they were going to find in the halls ahead. Not seeing anything to concern her, Anya stepped over the threshold. She froze, not daring to move, thoughts of pressure plates and booby traps racing through her mind.
The click came from behind me.
Without moving her feet or lower body, Anya turned her head and looked back. Rue was standing there, pistol in hand. He slapped the magazine back into place again. Then he realized she was watching him.
What? Better safe than sorry, right?
Right.
They followed the corridor beyond for a short distance before coming to another doorway. This one was shorter than the one before, and they had to duck to pass through it. On the other side was a small room. The chamber was roughly 10 by 12, if Anya had to hazard a guess, but it seemed smaller because much of the floor space was gobbled up by a large, ceremonial-looking pool. The water in it was clear and appeared to be reasonably deep. Anya guessed it was at least 6 feet, if not deeper. The pool was surrounded by a low stone wall that didn't quite reach her knees, but was just high enough to contain the water. As Rue walked over to look inside the pool, Anya headed for the far wall, searching for a way out. At first glance, there didn't seem to be one, and that didn't make much sense. Anya spun around. Rue had a rock in his hand and was getting ready to drop it into the water.
What are you doing?
I was curious how deep the water was. It seemed rather deceiving, so...
Both Rue and Anya spun around to the door. A thick stone slab was already more than halfway across the entrance.
No!
She frantically looked for something to jam into the opening to keep the slab from closing all the way. The slab fell into place. Anya reached it about the same time Rue did. They both threw their shoulders against it, trying to lever it back open. It was no use. The stone was too heavy.
Damn it!
Anya turned back to find another way out, when the surface of the water caught her eye. A moment ago, it had been clear. Now there was a spot of color. Specifically, red.
What on earth?
hurried over to take a look. A thin spiral of red was filling the center of the pool, lazily rising up from somewhere at the bottom. Already she was having trouble seeing the bottom as the red began to drift through the pool. The thick, viscous nature of the stuff reminded her of blood. Even as she watched, the water in the pool, now tainted with a slight blush of red, sloshed over the side of the wall. It wasn't much, just a cupful, really. But then that one little breach became two, then three. In the space of a few seconds, water was dripping over the stone containment wall in half a dozen places, pooling on what had seconds before been dry ground. Anya turned to Rue, who was still pushing the entrance.
Rue, we have to get out of here!
Brilliant deduction, Anya. I salute your powers of reasoning. Of course we have to get out of here. The only question is determining...
Rue!
What? I know we...
Look!
Rue did. He took in the water, now a much deeper red than it had been only seconds before, and the speed at which it was overflowing, and that was all it took. He immediately left off trying to force the door and began searching the walls. Anya started on the other side of the door and began to do the same thing.
There has to be a way out. You don't build a room with no way out of it unless... you wanted to trap someone in it.
Anya glanced back at the pool. The water was flowing much faster now, spilling out on all sides and beginning to accumulate. She ran her hands over the surface of the wall. She was looking for a nook, a niche, anything that might conceal a trigger to stop what was happening around her. She'd encountered hundreds of booby traps during her years as an archaeologist and adventurer, and more often than not, there was a safety. Something that could be used to stop from springing the trap or reset it.
The question is whether we'll find it in time.
Warm water splashed against her lower leg. The pool now covered the floor about an inch deep.
Oh, God!
The smell of the stuff hit her. That unmistakable metallic scent that clung to the back of her throat and made her want to retch.
That's blood, all right. And at the rate it's rising, if we don't do something soon, we're gonna drown in it.
Connolly and his group stood in front of the entrance to the fortress, flares held high, staring at footprints in the dust on the floor that led to the center doorway. Clearly, Anya and her companion had passed this way. Grimes glanced at the professor and noticed a frown crossing the man's face. Interesting.
Is there a problem, Professor?
No. We need to use the left entrance.
Ephraim took a step toward it, but Grimes stopped him with a hand on his elbow.
Why the left?
The place of honor at the table is always on the right. That's the obvious choice, therefore it won't be safe. It will be booby-trapped in some way.
Grimes kept eye contact with the man, looking for a sign that he was lying. The professor didn't even bat an eye.
All right, we'll take the left passage, and the professor will go first.
With the pool rising around them at a rapidly increasing rate, Anya knew time was of the essence. She tried to ignore it, but it was no use. Not finding anything in their respective positions, they moved farther along the walls in opposite directions, broadening their search. As the minutes ticked past, the bloody water rose around them, reaching their ankles, then their knees, then mid-thigh. Anya glanced at where Rue was standing, looking up and letting the beam of his headlamp play across the rock surface that was really only a few feet from his head.
Anything?
Nothing.
For what seemed like the millionth time, Anya glanced around, but the room was empty, except for the pool.
The pool.
Anya turned toward the source of their trouble, only to realize the low walls that marked the edge of the ceremonial basin had long since disappeared beneath the rising liquid. If it hadn't been for the bubbling in the center of the space, she wouldn't even have known it had been there in the first place.
The blood has to be coming from somewhere. The flow wasn't triggered until Rue dropped something into the pool, which means there's some mechanical process attached to either the height of the water or the additional weight on the bottom of the pool. I guess the latter. When the stone hit the bottom, it must have triggered a sluice of some kind that, when opened, flooded the room. Given how quickly the room is filling, that sluice has to be pretty big.
Anya stripped off her pack and handed it to Rue.
I've got an idea. Hold this.
She unzipped the pack and dug out her climbing rope. She tied one end around her waist, knotting it securely and handing the other to Rue.
What do you think you're doing?
Getting our asses out of here, that's what.
Anya waved a hand at the crimson tide that was nearly waist deep at this point.
All this stuff has to come from somewhere. The pipe that's pushing it in here is probably our only way out. I'm gonna dive down and see if it's wide enough for us to fit through. While I do that, you're gonna hold on to the rope. If you feel three tugs in a row, I want you to start pulling me back up as fast as you can.
You're nuts, you know that?
Yep, but nuts is better than dead, don't you think?
Hurry!
Anya sloshed her way over to the edge of the pool, using the fountain-like bubble in the center to guess where the edge was.
Ah!
She still managed to bang her knee on the retaining wall when she guessed incorrectly. Once in position, she flashed a thumbs up at Rue.